would like to welcome you all on behalf of HarperCollins. Let us welcome our guest of honor and our master of ceremonies, Howard Zinn.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Hugh Van Duzen, an editor who sticks with you for all these years and who does a tremendous job in getting your book out all over the country. He's been indispensable in the success of this book. I need also to thank Cynthia Merman, who was my first reader when HarperCollins was Harper and Row. And when I sent her this 600-page manuscript, expecting, well, she's going to come back with 20 pages of suggestions. And I got back a very short note from her saying, "This is wonderful." An editor is not supposed to do that. I hope I haven't gotten her in trouble by reporting on this. I must also thank my steadfast literary agent, Rick Balkin, who was instrumental in making the contact with HarperCollins, and he's been my agent and friend for many, many years. Not too many agents are friends, but he has been. I also must thank somebody who, when I thought I wouldn't write this, when I got discouraged, when I thought, this is too much, this is ridiculous, to write a whole damn history of the United States from Columbus down to the present day, and when I thought I would stop, my wife, Rosalind Zinn, said, "No, no." She said it softly, but determinedly. For tonight, and for this event tonight, yeah, I must thank Leslie Cohen of HarperCollins. I must thank the staff of the 92nd Street Y, all of whom have been terrific in working all the details out and organizing this. I need to thank Anthony Arnove and Joey Fox, who Anthony, was that you applauding? No. Anthony Arnove and Joey Fox did a great deal of work helping me sort of locate stuff and find materials. We worked hard putting this together and editing wonderful stuff down to almost wonderful stuff. And they, in fact, many of these things will appear in some later volume called Voices from a People's History. And now, I want to introduce these remarkable people, this set of artists, these actors, these writers, many of whom have come from across the country for this event tonight. Maybe I shouldn't give you their names, but I will, okay? Danny Glover, Andre Gregory, James Earl Jones, Myla Pitt, Marissa Tomei, Kurt Vonnegut, Alice Walker, Alfred Woodard, Harris Yulin, Jeff Zinn. From the first pages of the People's History of the United States.
My viewpoint in telling the history of the United States is that we must not accept the memory of states as our own. Nations are not communities and never have been. The history of any country, presented as the history of a family, conceals a fierce conflict of interest. And in such a world of conflict, a world of victims and executioners, the job of thinking people, as Albert Camus suggested, is not to be on the side of the executioners. Thus, in that inevitable taking of sides, which comes from selection and emphasis in history, I prefer to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution, from the standpoint of the slaves, of the rise of industrialism as seen by the young women in the Lowell textile mills, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by black soldiers on Luzon, the post-war American empire as seen by peons in Latin America, and so on, to the limited extent that any one person, however he or she strains, can see history from the standpoint of others. My point is not to grieve for the victims and denounce the executioners. Those tears, that anger, cast into the past, deplete our moral energy for the present. And the lines are not always clear. In the long run, the oppressor is also a victim. In the short run, the victims themselves, desperate and tainted with the culture that oppresses them, turn on other victims. Still, understanding the complexities, this book will be skeptical of governments and their attempts through politics and culture to ensnare ordinary people in a giant web of nationhood pretending to a common interest. I will try not to overlook the cruelties that victims inflict on one another as they are jammed together in the boxcars of the system. I don't want to romanticize them, but I do remember, in rough paraphrase, a statement I once heard. The cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you will never know what justice is.
Arawak, men and women, naked, tawny, full of wonder, emerged from their villages onto the island's beaches and swam out to get a closer look at the strange big boat. When Columbus and his sailors came ashore, carrying swords, speaking oddly, the Arawaks ran to greet them, brought them food, water, gifts. Columbus later wrote of this in his log.
They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears, many other things, which they exchanged for the glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well built, good bodies, handsome features. They do not bear arms and do not know them, for I showed them a sword. They took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all, make them do whatever we want.
We have no Indian voices to speak for the men and women of Hispaniola, but we have the volumes written by the Spanish priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, who was an eyewitness to what happened after Columbus came.
These people are by nature the most humble, patient, and easeable, holding no grudges, free from embroilments, neither excitable nor quarrelsome. These people are the most devoid of rancors, hatred, or desire for vengeance of any people in the world. Yet into this sheepfold, there came some Spaniards who immediately behaved like ravening wild beasts, wolves, tigers, or lions that had been starved for many days. And Spaniards have behaved in no other way during the past 40 years, down to the present time, for they are still acting like ravening beasts, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, and destroying the native peoples, doing all of this with the strangest and most varied new methods of cruelty never seen or heard of before, and to such a degree that this island of Hispaniola, once so populous, having population that I estimated to be more than 3 millions, has now a population of barely 200 persons.
Our political leaders like to pretend that there are no classes in this country, that all of us have the same interest, Exxon and me, George Bush and you. But we've always had classes in this country, class conflict, class struggle. Before the American Revolution, there were riots of the poor against the rich, of tenants against landlords, flower riots and food riots. During the Revolution, in George Washington's army, there were mutinies of soldiers who resented the privileges of the officer class and the way they themselves were treated, and they mutinied, and then Washington ordered the execution of some of them, execution done by their fellow mutineers. After the war, veterans who'd been given small amounts of land found themselves so heavily taxed they couldn't meet their payments. In western Massachusetts, thousands of farmers surrounded the courthouses where their farms were being auctioned off and refused to allow the courts to proceed. Eventually, Shays' Rebellion, as it was called, was crushed, but it put a scare into the founding fathers. And when they met in 1787, a year later, to create a constitution, they made sure to set up a government strong enough to put down the uprisings of the poor. These are the words of one of the participants in Shays' Rebellion, a man named Plow Jogger.
I've labored hard all my days and fared hard. I've been greatly abused. I've been obliged to do more than my part in the war. Been loaded with class rates, town rates, province rates, continental rates, and all rates. Been pulled and hauled by sheriffs, constables, and collectors. Had my cattle sold for less than they were worth. I've been obliged to pay, and nobody will pay me. I have lost a great deal by this man and that man and t'other man. The great men are going to get all we have. I think it's time for us to rise and put a stop to it. Have no more courts, nor sheriffs, nor collectors, nor lawyers. And I know that we are the biggest party. Let them say what they will. We've come to relieve the distresses of the people. There will be no court until they have redress of their grievances.
What is too often overlooked in a triumphal story of the growth of American industry in the 19th century is the human cost of that triumph, the lives cut short, the maimed bodies of the men and women who worked in the factories, the mills. In the Lowell, Massachusetts textile mills of 1836, where girls went to work at the age of 12 and often died by the time they were 25, one of the first strikes of mill girls took place. It is described by one of them, Harriet Hansen.
When it was announced that wages were to be cut down, Great indignation was felt, and it was decided to strike en masse. This was done. The mills were shut down, and the girls went in procession from their several corporations to the Grove on Chapel Hill and listened to incendiary speeches. One of the girls stood on a pump and gave vent to the feelings of her companions in a neat speech, declaring that it was their duty to resist all attempts at cutting down the wages. This was the first time a woman had spoken in public in Lowell, and the event caused surprise and consternation amongst her audience. My own recollection of this first strike, or turnout as it was called, is very vivid. I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I had been an ardent listener to what was said against this attempt at oppression on the part of the corporation, and naturally I took side with the strikers. When the day came on which the girls were to turn out, those in the upper room started first, and so many of them left that our mill was at once shut down. Then, when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, asking each other, "Would you or shall we turn out?" and not one of them having the courage to lead off, I, who began to think they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with childish bravado, "I don't care what you do, I am going to turn out, whether anyone else does or not." And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I looked back at the long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been at any success I may have achieved.
As part of the long process of driving the Indians off their native lands, Andrew Jackson in the 1830s signed an order to remove by force the five civilized tribes from their territory in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and drive them westward across the Mississippi. There followed what became known as the Trail of Tears, in which 16,000 men, women, children, surrounded by the United States Army, made the long trip westward, and 4,000 of them died. The Cherokees and Seminoles resisted, and here they speak to the government of the United States.
"We are aware that some persons suppose it will be for our advantage to remove beyond the Mississippi. We think otherwise. Our people universally think otherwise. We wish to remain on the land of our fathers. We have a perfect and original right to remain without interruption or molestation. The treaties with us and the laws of the United States made in pursuance of treaties guarantee our residence and our privileges and secure us against intruders. Our only request is that these treaties may be fulfilled and these laws executed. We entreat those to whom the foregoing paragraphs are addressed to remember the law, the great law of love. Do to others as ye would that others would do to you. We pray them to remember that for the sake of principle, their forefathers were compelled to leave, therefore driven from the old world, and that the winds of persecution raft them across the great waters and landed them on the shores of the new world, when the Indian was the sole lord and proprietor of these extensive domains. Let them remember in what way they were received by the savage of America when power was in his hand. We were all made by the same great father and are all alike his children. We all come from the same mother and were suckled at the same breast. Therefore, we are brothers, and as brothers should treat together in an amicable way. Your talk is a good one, but my people cannot say they will go. We are not willing to do so. If suddenly we tear our hearts from the homes around which they are twined,
our heartstrings will snap.
Women. Women, black and white, played a critical part in the building of the anti-slavery movement in the United States. They worked in anti-slavery societies all over the country, gathering thousands of petitions to Congress. But when, in 1840, a World Anti-Slavery Society convention met in London, there was a fierce argument about whether women could attend. The final vote was that they could only attend meetings in a curtained enclosure. They sat in silent protest in the gallery, and when they returned to the United States, they began to lay the basis for the first women's rights convention in history. It was held at Seneca Falls, New York, where Elizabeth Cady Stanton lived as a mother, a housewife, full of resentment at her condition, declaring, "A woman is a nobody. A wife is everything." The convention was attended by 300 women and some men who adopted a declaration of principles, making use of the language and rhythm of the Declaration of Independence.
"We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it and to insist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers on such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. When a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. Man has endeavored in every way that he could to destroy her confidence in her own powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life. Now, in view of this entire disfranchisement of one half the people in this country, their social and religious degradation, in view of the unjust laws mentioned above, and because women do feel themselves aggrieved, oppressed, and fraudulently deprived of their most sacred rights, we insist that they have immediate admission to the rights and privileges which belong to them as citizens of the United States."
Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, once a slave, became a brilliant and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement. In 1852, he was asked to speak in celebration of the 4th of July.
"Fellow citizens, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
John Brown. John Brown. John Brown, more than any other white American, devoted his life and finally sacrificed it on behalf of freedom for the slave. His plan, impossible and courageous, was to seize the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, with a band of black and white abolitionists and set off a revolt of slaves throughout the South. The plan failed. Some of his men, including two of his own sons, were killed. John Brown was wounded, captured, sentenced to death by hanging by the state of Virginia, and with the enthusiastic approval of the government of the United States. When he was put to death, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "He will make the gallows holy as the cross." Here, John Brown addresses the court that ordered his hanging.
Had I interfered in the manner, which I admit, had I so interfered in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, or in behalf of any of their friends, or father, mother, brother, sister, wife, or children, or any of that class, and suffered and sacrificed what I have in this interference, it would have been all right. Every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than of punishment. This court acknowledges, too, as I suppose, the validity of the law of God. I see a book kissed, which I suppose to be the Bible, or at least the New Testament, which teaches me that all things whatsoever I would that men should do to me, I should do even so to them. I endeavor to act up to that instruction. I say I am yet too young to understand that God is any respecter of persons. I believe that to have interfered as I've done, as I've always freely admitted I have done, in behalf of his despised poor, I did not wrong, but right. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and with the blood of millions in this slave country, whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I submit. So let it be done.
Twenty-two years later, in 1881, Frederick Douglass was asked to speak at a college in Harper's Ferry.
If John Brown did not end the war that ended slavery, he did at least begin the war that ended slavery. If we look over the dates, places, and men for which this honor is claimed, we shall find that not Carolina, but Virginia, not Fort Sumter, but Harper's Ferry and the Arsenal, not Colonel Anderson, but John Brown began the war that ended American slavery and made this a free republic. Until that blow was struck, the prospect of freedom was dim, shadowy, and uncertain. The irrepressible conflict was one of words, votes, and compromises. When John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared.
After the Civil War, with the federal government enforcing the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution, guaranteeing the right to vote to black people, African Americans were elected to governing bodies throughout the South. But after a few years of what might be called radical Reconstruction, the political and business interests of the North made a deal with those of the South to withdraw federal power and allow the white South to have its way. Henry McNeil Turner, elected to the state legislature of Georgia, was expelled by that body in 1872. But before he left, he addressed his colleagues.
Mr. Speaker, I wish the members of this House to understand the position that I take. I hold that I am a member of this body. Therefore, sir, I shall never flaunt or cringe before any party, nor stoop to beg them for my rights. I am here to demand my rights and to hurl thunderbolts at the men who would dare to cross the threshold of my manhood. The scene presented in this House today is one unparalleled in the history of the world. Never in the history of the world has a man been arraigned before a body clothed with legislative, judicial, and executive functions, charged with the offense of being of a darker hue than his fellow men. It has remained for the state of Georgia in the very heart of the 19th century to call a man before the bar and there charge him with an act for which he is no more responsible than the head which carries upon his shoulders. The Anglo-Saxon race, sir, is a most surprising one. I was not aware that there was in the character of the race so much cowardice or so much pusillanimity I tell you, sir, that this is a question which will not die today. This event shall be remembered for prosperity for ages yet to come. And while the sun shall continue to climb the hills of heaven, we are told that if black men want to speak, they must speak through white trumpets. If black men wants their sentiments expressed, they must be adulterated and sent through white messengers who will quibble and equivocate and evade as rapidly as the pendulum of a clock. The great question, sir, is this: am I a man? If I am such, I claim the rights of a man. Why, sir, though we are not white, we have accomplished much. We have built up your country. We have worked in your fields and garnered your harvests for 250 years. And what do we as asked of you in return? Do we ask you for compensation for the sweat of our fathers they bore for you, for the tears you have caused, and for the hearts you have broken, and the lives you have curtailed, and the blood you have spilled? Do we ask retaliation? We asked it not. We are willing to let the dead past buried is dead, but we ask you now for our rights.
The orthodox texts in American history pay much attention to what was called a splendid little war, the victory of the United States in the three-month-long Spanish-American War of 1898. But these texts slide quickly over the bloody conquest of the Philippines that went on for years, which President McKinley said was necessary to civilize and Christianize the Filipinos, and which Theodore Roosevelt hailed as the newest outpost of the American empire. Roosevelt loved war and militarism, and when the army massacred 600 Moros on a southern island in the Philippines in 1906, Roosevelt congratulated the commanding general. Here is Mark Twain's response.
This incident burst upon the world last Friday in an official cablegram from the commander of our forces in the Philippines to our government at Washington. The substance of it was as follows. A tribe of Moros, dark-skinned savages, had fortified themselves in the bowl of an extinct crater not many miles from Jolo. And as they were hostiles and bitter against us, because we've been trying for 8 years to take their liberties away from them, their presence in that position was a menace. Our commander, General Leonard Woods, ordered a reconnaissance. It was found that the Moros numbered 600, counting women and children, and their crater bowl was in the summit of a peak or mountain 2,200 feet above sea level, and very difficult of access for Christian troops and artillery. Then General Wood ordered a surprise and went along himself to see the order carried out. General Wood's order was, kill or capture the 600. There, with 600 engaged on each side, we lost 15 men killed outright, and we had 32 wounded, counting that nose and that elbow. The enemy numbered 600, including women and children, and we abolished them utterly, leaving not even a baby alive to cry for its dead mother. This is incomparably the greatest victory that was ever achieved by the Christian soldiers of the United States. So far as I can find out, there was only one person among our 80 millions who allowed himself the privilege of a public remark on this great occasion. That was the President of the United States. All day Friday, he was studiously silent as the rest. But on Saturday, he recognized that his duty required him to say something, and he took his pen and performed that duty. This is what he said. Washington, March 10th, to General Wood, Manila. I congratulate you and the officers and men of your command upon the brilliant feat of arms wherein you and they did so well upheld the honor of the American flag. Signed, Theodore Roosevelt. I have read carefully the Treaty of Paris. I have seen that we do not intend to free, but to subjugate the people of the Philippines. We have gone there to conquer, not to redeem. It should, it seems to me, be our pleasure and duty to make these people free and let them deal with their own domestic questions in their own way. And so, I am an anti-imperialist. I am opposed to having the eagle put its talons on any other land.
The IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, was a radical labor organization of the early 20th century. It organized all workers, black, white, men, women, native-born, foreign, skilled, unskilled, which the American Federation of Labor refused to do. Its goal was revolutionary, to take over the industrial system and run it for the benefit of the people. When immigrant women in the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, went on strike in 1912, they were met with police violence and judicial intimidation. The IWW poet and organizer, Arturo Giovannitti, was arrested on spurious charges for murder. Here is a speech to the jury, which found him innocent.
Mr. Foreman and gentlemen of the jury, it is the first time in my life that I speak publicly in your wonderful language, and it is the most solemn moment in my life. There has been brought only one side of this great industrial question, only the method and only the tactics, but what about the ethical part of the question? What about the better and nobler humanity, where there shall be no more slaves, where no man will ever be obliged to go on strike in order to obtain 50 cents a week more, where children will not have to starve anymore, where women no more will have to go and prostitute themselves, where at last there will not be any more slaves, any more masters, but just one great family of friends and brothers. They say you are free in this great and wonderful country. I say that politically you are, and my best compliments and congratulations. But I say you cannot be half free and half slave. And economically, all the working class in the United States are as much slaves now as the Negroes were 40 and 50 years ago. Because the man that owns the tool where another man works, the man that owns the house where this man lives, the man that owns the factory where this man wants to go to work, that man owns and controls the bread that that man eats, and therefore owns and controls his mind, his body, his heart, and his soul. I am 29 years old. Not quite. I have a woman that loves me and that I love. I have a mother and father that are waiting for me. I have an ideal that is dear to me that can be expressed or understood. And life has so many allurements, and it is so nice and so bright and so wonderful that I felt the passion of living in my heart, and I do want to live. Whichever way you judge, gentlemen of the jury, I thank you.
In the year 1914, 1,000 miners with wives and children who had gone on strike against the Rockefeller-owned coal mines in southern Colorado were holding out in a tent colony near the tiny hamlet of Ludlow. One day in April, the National Guard, financed by Rockefeller, began pouring machine gun fire into the tent colony and then came down from the hills and set fire to the tents. The next day, the bodies of 11 children and two women were found, suffocated, burned to death. This became known as the Ludlow Massacre. Mother Mary Jones, 82-year-old organizer for the mine workers, had come to Colorado to support the miners, and on the eve of their strike, as they gathered in the opera house in Trinidad, she spoke to them.
What would the coal in the mines be worth if you did not work to take it out? The time is ripe for you to stand like men. I know something about strikes. I didn't go into them yesterday. I was carried 84 miles and landed in jail by a United States Marshal in the night because I was talking to a miners' meeting. The next morning I was brought to court, and the judge said to me, "Did you read my injunction? Did you understand that the injunction told you not to look at the miners? As long as the judge who is higher than you leaves me sight, I will look at anything I want to," said I. The old judge died soon after that, and the injunction died with him. At another time, when in the courtroom, the bailiff said to me, "When you are addressing the court, you must say your honor." "I don't know whether he has any or not," said I. Someone said to me, "You don't believe in charity work, mother?" "No, I don't believe in charity. It is a vice. We need the upbuilding of justice to mankind. We don't need your charity. All we need is an opportunity to live like men and women in this country. I want you to pledge yourselves in this convention to stand as one solid army against the foes of human labor. Think of the thousands who are killed every day, and there is no redress for it. We will fight until the mines are made secure and human life valued more than props. Look things in the face. Don't fear a governor. Don't fear anybody. You pay the governor. He has a right to protect you. You are the biggest part of this population, the biggest part of the population in this state. You create its wealth. So I say, let the fight go on. If anybody else, nobody else will keep on. I will.
Emma Goldman. Emma Goldman, in the early part of the 20th century, became one of the most powerful voices in America for anarchism, feminism, the rights of working people. She lectured all over the country on women's rights, on the theater of Shaw, Ibsen, Strindberg, on patriotism and war. She was arrested many times. She was jailed for opposing World War I and then was deported under the personal supervision of J. Edgar Hoover. Here in the year 1916, she addresses a courtroom where she has been charged with speaking about birth control.
"Your Honor, I am charged with the crime of having given information to men and women as to how to prevent conception. For the last 3 weeks, every night before packed houses, a stirring social indictment is being played at the Candler Theater. I refer to Justice by John Galsworthy. The counsel for the defense, in summing up the charge against the defendant, says, among other things, 'Your Honor, back of the commission of every crime is life, palpitating life.' Now, what is the palpitating life back of my crime? I will tell you, Your Honor. According to the bulletin of the Department of Health, 30 million people in America are underfed. Your Honor, what kind of children do you suppose these parents can bring into the world? I will tell you, children so poor and anemic that they take their leave of this, our kind world, before their first year of life. In that way, 300,000 babies, according to the Baby Welfare Association, are sacrificed in the United States every year. This, Your Honor, is the palpitating life which has confronted me for many years, and which is back of the commission of my crime. After all, the question of birth control is largely a working man's question, above all, a working woman's question. She it is who risks her health, her youth, her very life, in giving out of herself the units of the race. She it is who ought to have the means and the knowledge to say how many children she will have, and to what purpose she shall have them, and under what conditions she shall bring forth life. And this is true, not only because of what I say or may not say. There is much profounder reason for the tremendous growth and importance of birth control. The reason is conditioned in the great modern social conflict, or rather social war, I might say. A war not for military conquest or material supremacy, a war of the oppressed and disinherited of the earth against their enemies, capitalism and the state. A war for a seat at the table of life. A war for well-being, for beauty, for liberty. Above all, this is a war for a free motherhood and a joyous, playful, glorious childhood.
Helen Keller is presented to American school children as an extraordinary person who overcame blindness and deafness and became internationally famous. What our schools do not say about Helen Keller is that she was a socialist, a radical, that she opposed war and militarism, that she walked on picket lines. But because she was blind, they said that her disability limited her understanding of social issues. The editor of the Brooklyn Eagle, who had once praised her lavishly, changed his mind when she declared herself a socialist, whereupon she wrote a letter to the newspaper addressing it, "Poor Blind Eagle." Here she speaks in Carnegie Hall on the eve of America's entrance into the First World War.
We are facing a grave crisis in our national life. The few who profit from the labor of the masses want to organize the workers into an army which will protect the interests of the capitalists. You are urged and asked to add to the heavy burdens you already bear, the burden of a larger army and many additional warships. It is in your power to refuse. Congress is not preparing to defend the people of the United States. It is planning to protect the capital of American speculators and investors in Mexico, South America, China, and the Philippine Islands. Those preparedness propagandists want to give the people something to think about besides their own unhappy condition. Every few days, we are given a new scare to lend realism to their propaganda. People are taught that brave men die for their country's honor. What a price to pay for an abstraction. The lives of millions of young men, other millions crippled and blinded for life, existence made hideous for still more millions of human beings, the achievement and inheritance of generations swept away in a moment, and nobody better off for all the misery. Strike against the war. Without you, no battles can be fought. Strike against manufacturing bombs and tools of murder. Strike against preparedness that really means death and misery to millions of human beings. Be not dumb, obedient slaves in an army of destruction. Be heroes in an army of construction.
Eugene Debs led a national strike of railroad workers in 1894 and spent 6 months in jail for that. He went into prison a labor leader and came out a socialist. As leader of the Socialist Party, he ran for president 3 times. When the United States entered the First World War, President Wilson signed the Espionage Act, which provided long jail terms for anyone who said anything that might discourage recruitment in the armed forces. A filmmaker who made a movie about the American Revolution depicting the British as enemies was sentenced to 10 years in prison because now the British were our allies. His film was called The Spirit of 76, and the court case against him was U.S. versus Spirit of 76. Debs spoke against the war, was arrested for violating the Espionage Act, and his conviction was upheld unanimously by the Supreme Court, which pointed to his statement that, quote, the master class has always made the wars, the working class has always fought them. Here, at his trial in the fall of 1918, he is speaking to the court.
Your Honor, years ago, I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it, and while there is a criminal element, I am of it, and while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. Your Honor, I have stated in this court that I am opposed to the social system in which we live, that I believe in a fundamental change, but if possible, by peaceable and orderly means. Standing here this morning, I recall my boyhood. At 14, I went to work in a railroad shop. At 16, I was firing a freight engine on a railroad. I remember all the hardships and privations of the earlier day, and from that time until now, my heart has been with the working class. I could have been in Congress long ago. I've preferred to go to prison. I am thinking this morning of the men in the mills and the factories, of the men in the mines and on the railroads. I'm thinking of the women who, for a paltry wage, are compelled to work out their barren lives, of the little children who in this system are robbed of their childhood and in their tender years are seized in the remorseless grasp of mammon and forced into the industrial dungeons, there to feed the monster machines while they themselves are being starved and stunted, body and soul. I see them dwarfed and diseased and their little lives broken and blasted because in this high noon of Christian civilization, money is still much more important than the flesh and blood of childhood. In very truth, gold is the god today and rules with pitiless sway in the affairs of men. I am opposing a social order in which it is possible for one man who does absolutely nothing that is useful to amass a fortune of hundreds of millions of dollars, while millions of men and women who work all the days of their lives secure barely enough for a wretched existence. This order of things cannot always endure. I have registered my protest against it. I recognize the feebleness of my effort, but fortunately, I am not alone. I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity. The people are awakening. In due time, they will and must come into their own.